Chairman, we shouldn't recognize this because the attempt is to pull the bill out of committee, and I'd like to have a ruling on you just on that point, if you allow that.
Considering here, Representative Henley?
I'll give you a brief explanation. There's three parts to this. One is House Bill 458, which is Representative Davies' bill in committee. One is House Bill 362, which is Representative Martin's bill in committee. And the other is Amendment Number 4 that we turned down earlier about adult public assistance. So we turned down the adult public assistance amendment, and these are two other bills. I would also suggest that I support... Well, I don't know Representative Davies' bill that much. That's why it's so long. I mean, there really are other bills that are in the legislative process. There may be a whole bunch more we could add on, too. I would agree that getting increased child support is very important for decreasing the amount of AFDC that we pay in this state, because the more money that people get that they're owed, the less... Mm-hmm. I mean, the more money they have to spend, which means they don't have to accept some of these programs. But I'm not sure that I haven't talked to the chairs of the committees that these bills are in. I understand why they aren't going anywhere, and I haven't. So I'd be a little concerned about pulling the bill out.
Mr. Chairman.
Chairman McKinney.
I support the child support payments very much, and I believe that they're needed, but I don't believe that it's very fair to be pulling a bill out of committee.
Okay. What I was going to rule here is that, I guess, good try, Representative Wright. But I think what you were looking for is to elevate the level of discussion on this subject. And if someone would like to discuss these two things, because I think it is a concern around the table here, that we can find a way, if we don't want to pull a bill out of committee, probably we can find a way to get some action to direct attention to this. Representative Navarre?
Mr. Chairman, I'm just wondering what your ruling is, because while you may not like to pull out a bill out of committee, an amendment is an amendment and is clearly allowed. Whether it pulls a bill out of committee or not, you can vote against it, but you can't rule it out of order.
I just told him, nice try. I didn't say out of order yet.
You can, absolutely.
Representative Martin?
On the board, you can, absolutely, sir. The same way you have been most successful on the floor when I so belligerently tried to do such in a couple of years when we were in a minority and pulled bills out of committee.
Uh-huh.
That's what I'm saying. Roll now, and I pulled the chair.
Chairman.
Representative Hoffman.
It's a good idea. Let's not pull it out of committee. Let's yank it out of committee.
Kick it out.
The motion before us is the adoption of Amendment Number 7. We have a discussion in regards to the merits, and in my opinion, that many members of the committee do support the merits. However, the concern was pulling the bill out of committee, in which House Bill 458 and House Bill 362 are two of the provisions here, and I think as Representative Henley pointed out, Amendment Number 4, which has already failed to pass committee, is part of it. So with that, then, we will vote on the motion to adopt Amendment Number 7. Representative Navarre?
Maybe we could seek a compromise here, since I'm certain that the motion will fail. And it will fail not on its merits. It will fail based on the fact that you don't want to jerk a bill out of committee. Maybe we could draft a letter by the Finance Committee to the committees that are holding these bills and say, look, a majority of the Finance Committee is interested in addressing this issue on its merits. Would you please move the bill?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Martin?
The problem would probably be solved if some of the minority members of that committee would let it go through. Ironically, that's where part of the problem is.
Representative Henley?
I would support Representative Navarre's approach in it. I generally support what I think is in these bills, but to be honest with you, there's 15 pages here. I think if we're going to do an honest job at this committee on these things, that we need to have the department's testimony about 150 days and Class B misdemeanors and eligibility period. I mean, there's a lot of stuff in here, so I would support sending a letter saying that we think some of these things should be addressed.
I'm going to throw something out and see if it's satisfactory that send a copy of this amendment to the Hess Committee, stating, of course, that the subject in these amendments were discussed, and that the committee felt that, you know, there was merit in the discussion, and that, however, we did not want to, quote-unquote, pull or yank a bill from committee, we'd appreciate hearing what action the Hess Committee is going to take on this piece of legislation.
Just an editorial comment as a follow-up to Representative Hanley's comment, and that is, if we really wanted to do an honest job, we'd dissolve a couple of those other committees.
Okay. Are there any objections to Representative Navarre and Representative Hanley's suggestion that we do draft a memo sending along the proposed amendment, stating, of course, that it was briefly discussed within the Finance Committee, that the consensus was we generally support the concept, and not wanting to pull a bill out of committee, we're wondering what action the Hess Committee has taken on this subject.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Martin.
Mr. Chairman, I have three other bills I'd like to add to that.
Mr. Chairman.
I think we start having title problems.
For the audience information, Representative Martin has some bills we really love. We just don't want to let them go. Representative Brown?
I was just going to ask whether any of those other bills relate to child support enforcement.
No, that was the main one.
Representative
well,
not Brown,
the big one, as you know.
In light of what we just agreed to, would you remove your motion to adopt amendment number 7?
Yes, I will withdraw amendment number 7. I will say this. It's distressing to me that we're moving forward to make these reductions and to the people that we're addressing here when we're not taking these obvious actions, corrective actions, that could do something to achieve your goal, all of our goal, which is to have a lower budget for AFDC. You've heard the prime sponsor or one of the bills say, you know, it doesn't look that great that the bill's going to get out of committee, so we can send this letter, but what effect is it going to have? What effect is it going to have? And I'm further concerned because of the actions that the Revenue Subcommittee has taken and not, in my opinion, adequately funding the child support enforcement collection effort in the revenue budget. So it seems like we're going to call welfare reform reductions to the people that are most affected, and we're not going to do the other things that we need to do to get a long-term handle on the problem. So that's why I'm not, you know, very enthusiastic about losing this opportunity to address child support enforcement. Where else are we going to get to take it up?
Okay. I would say basically in light of your first comment, we won't know what the committee's action is until we contact them on it. Second, in regards to the revenue budget, that will be up before the Finance Committee sometime before next Tuesday. So,
Mr. Chairman, I guess I think that if we were to make a serious effort for child support enforcement, we would more than make up the amount that's going to be saved in these ratable reductions that the committee seems intent on moving forward with.
Sounds like Representative Brown may have an amendment.
I'm sure I will, but I will withdraw number 7.
Okay. Are there any objections to the amendment being withdrawn? Hearing none, we move to amendment number 8. Representative McCain?
Yes, I'd like to move amendment number 8, and I'll give you my explanation for it.
Okay. Representative McCain, please do.
Mr. Chairman, I don't know that I have number 8.
Was handed out right at the beginning. Chairman McLean.
Thank you. The department will pretty much, what it does is that the department will assess the availability of activities for the workfare provision. And one of the concerns that we had, like the North Slope Borough and the outlying villages, they have culturally related activities during different parts of the season. And we thought that maybe if the regulations were too strict, that they might restrict the cultural related activities that the recipients could be involved in. For example, a lot of the people that are on AFDC, APA, they're seasonal workers, and pretty much they will quit their jobs, especially like during whaling season, but they would rather be out like making an ice trail to the whaling camps. So that's that was my concern.
Okay, we have a motion to adopt number 8. We've had an explanation of the amendment. Any discussion?
Mr. Chairman, I'll just say I don't have a, I mean, I think the department should consider the local communities when they're implementing the program. So it says they shall consider those recommended by governmental agencies representing the communities in the project area. So I don't have a problem. I don't think that would be a problem.
Are there any objections to Amendment Number 8? Any objections? Hearing none, Amendment Number 8 has been adopted. Next, we come to Amendment Number 9. Amendment Number 9, Representative Brown.
Mr. Chairman, Amendment Number 9 would reduce the rateable for AFDC and adult public assistance from 1.7% to 0.7%. And I don't know if the copies are yet made, but the department, and maybe we could ask Jan Hansen to address this, at the request of Representative Davis, did a spread on what this amount of savings would be. And I did ask, no, here it is. You can go ahead and distribute. The bottom line is a difference of $4.5 million, roughly. The total cumulative savings, I believe, under the 1.7% cut are $8.3 million, roughly. This would reduce the total savings to $3.751 million. And again, what it would do, the amendment would reduce the amount of the cut to both adult public assistance and AFDC to 0.7%. So we would be cutting AFDC payments by a little more than $2 million and cutting adult public assistance by $1.7 million for a total general fund savings of $3.7 million. And those, you can see that on the sheet that's been distributed about, oh, maybe a third of the way down on page 1 where it says FSGF reduction. And then on the next page, the line cumulative difference about a third of the way down the page. And Ms. Hansen, I think, prepared the sheet and could speak to any questions that people have about it.
Ms. Hansen, Representative Hanley?
If I could ask. So I'm trying to figure, if you look at the fiscal note that we have, I think what it, and we haven't got an updated one with Fairbanks Community in it, but I think what would happen is we would actually, in fiscal year 95, what is the additional amount of the, 829, so it would be about...
I guess maybe, Ms. Hansen, what the information we need is that under the bill as proposed, what would be the impact on adult public assistance and what would be the impact on AFDC in dollar amount, and then how much this proposed amendment would reduce those dollars amount.
Mr. Chairman, I will attempt to do this. We did prepare this document. I've not looked at it for since the date it was prepared. The not sure that I can immediately match up the numbers in order to respond to your question, and I don't want to mislead. We, in the bill, the analysis as it is, there is much more savings generated in HB 409 than is equivalent to the rateable reduction, because over the course of the demonstration project, there are savings from the project. And Mr. Chairman, I would have to sit down and actually, I can't give you the number whether the bottom line comes out equal with this. And I don't have my administrative officer here with me. Hanley may have done.
I haven't actually. I didn't see this one. The I think what would happen, though, is with the addition of Fairbanks and the reduction here, that in FY 95, probably looking at a roughly $100,000, instead of a net general fund impact of $600,000 reduction, it would be $100,000 additional money in the 95 budget we'd have to put in. And then in the 96 budget particularly, I think it would be about whatever the total reduction is, it would be about $1 million of additional money that we would have to add in the FY 96 budget, because that's about how much was reduced. That's the savings. The savings for all the ratable reductions is about $1.7 million, and under the scenario proposed, I think it would be about $700,000 savings. And in fact, that almost works out to 1.7%. But so there'd be about $1 million additional with the additional money. So at least on the front end, we'd be appropriating net general fund dollars into the budget.
Could I ask?
Representative Brown.
Thank you. Could you discuss how you would be able to average these costs so that you don't have the lumpiness in the cost of the project?
Mr. Chair, Representative Brown, the lumpiness of the project, if by that you mean that there are more costs in some years than in others,
correct?
I'm correct. There's no way for us to get around, and again, I have to say that we're looking at two separate things. We're looking at what it will cost us and how much appropriated dollars we would need in order to carry out the demonstration projects as defined in HB 409. And to do that, there are certain amounts of dollars that need to be allocated, and prior to there being any savings, because we have about 18 months of upfront costs before we can even begin generating savings. When we talk about the size of the ratable reduction, or we talk about the lumpiness of the cost, from the federal perspective, they will look at the demonstration project to determine if it was cost neutral, and they'll look over the whole year. So the federal government will look and see it cost us more in year one, but we saved more in year four, and they will determine cost neutrality over the whole. So from the federal perspective, the neutrality goes over all years. Where we come is, no matter how the legislature determines that they want to fund it, is that we need the allocation. As a division, I can't write a check on dollars that are going to be in FY97's budget. They have to be allocated for me in FY95's budget. And I think that's the issue of when the money is there.
Well, Ms. Sherman, it looks to me like that the ratables that are now in the bill raise more than is required, a significant amount more than is required for the implementation of these projects. And if you can see that by looking at the total over the five-year period, we're going to save 7.3, correct, over the status quo. So I think the effect of this amendment would be that we'd save, I think, somewhere in the neighborhood of 3.5 million over the status quo. Do you agree that that's, I'm reading this correctly?
Mr. Chairman, that's that is correct, that over the life of the project, a lower ratable reduction, such as is proposed here, would not cost the state anything if these projections are correct. It would come out that there would still be some slight savings, or it would, from my quick reading of the figures, it would come out close to cost neutral. The biggest issue happens in fiscal year 96, which on the chart you have, the last time we revised it, February 22nd, that's the year that shows the lowest net gain. Right now there's a net gain to the state in each year of the project. The lowest year of gain is in FY 96, which shows us $253,000. However, once we add in the Fairbanks addition to the project, though we don't have the final figures, we have begun working on them, and it would appear that in FY 96, adding Fairbanks, there is no net gain that year. So the one year of the project that is particularly problematic becomes FY 96, if you're trying to look at the ratable reduction eating, matching, and funding the cost of the project.
I don't know if I heard correctly.
Just to respond to that in addition, that the way this is right now, if there had been no other amendments and this was the only amendment here, it would come out cost neutral over the life of the project. Since the there already has been an amendment to expand the project by adding Fairbanks, and we don't have that figure here, I can't definitively say that, but my belief is that with the expansion of the project to include another area, it's possible that a ratable of this size would not meet the cost over the lifetime. But I can't absolutely say that yet.
Representative Henley?
Maybe I can, if people have their fiscal note, basically, and it seems strange, or I've said even crazy, it costs money to have a program. So the cost of implementing this actual program is about $1.7 million a year, roughly. It's the eligibility determination people, administration, data processing, work programs, child care benefits. And so basically, if you look across the bottom, it's a little bit more than that. It's about $1.8 million. The ratable reduction, and that continues. It's just in FY95, there's just a startup cost. In FY96, it's a half year. No, it's the full year. And in FY99, it's actually a half year because it doesn't run through the whole year. So it's about $1.8 million a year for all the child care, et cetera, and administration of the project. That continues throughout the whole time. The ratable reduction is about $1.8 million per year. It's a little less earlier and a little more later, but that's about the cost of the administration. So the other savings are the anticipated savings, if they're all estimates, as to what the amount of AFDC payments and Medicare or Medicaid costs will be reduced, and that's where the other amount of the savings are. So if you want to guarantee, you know, the ratable reduction covers the cost of the project, period, and the savings come in anticipated and hopefully the savings cost of the program. One of the problems is if you want to spread out the costs start right up front, and the savings don't. So, you know, you've got this problem where you got $1.8 million in FY96, and you got about, under the proposal by Representative Brown, I think you'd have about $1 million of savings to cover that cost. So you'd have about $800,000 increase in a budget, I guess you'd say, of additional general fund dollars. So, I mean, I asked them to run this so that the net cost of the thing were in the worst year that we didn't add money to the budget. You know, the cost savings from these things would cover it. So, it's real hard to average it without. To pull potential savings, which we hope are there, up into the first year of FY96, I don't know how you do that other than I would just prefer to leave it the way it is.
Representative Brown?
What is the basis for the projected AFDC savings? I mean, your expectation of people who are actually going to get off of AFDC or going to not be allowed to stay on past a certain point?
Chairman Representative Brown, the AFDC savings come from two. The smallest part of it is people who actually go off, because we don't, there's a fairly small number of people who earn enough to go off. The larger part of the AFDC savings is of people who go to work, who wouldn't have gone to work if it wasn't for the elimination of the 100-hour rule and the increased earnings incentives. And so someone that's getting $923 now, because they go to work as a result of the project, they only get $523. That $400 a month becomes savings. And so for all of those calculations comes out to AFDC savings.
Okay, further discussion on amendment number 9. Senator Brown.
Well, just in conclusion, I'd say I don't agree with one of the premises of this bill, which is that we should be finding the money for welfare reform by reducing these payments to the recipients. And certainly, I think the notion of doing something to change the system, to give people more incentives and those things are very positive. It's just that the people that are going to be affected by this, I think, will notice the difference when you're that close to the edge. A small amount makes a lot of difference. And, you know, again, I'd remind the committee we're making reductions here in adult public assistance, and those people have nothing to do with this program or supporting this. And really, is it reasonable or should we expect that those people can fix their situation to the point that they can, you know, become employable? And I just don't believe that it is. So I think to make this bill and this project more revenue neutral, We could reduce the ratable a little bit and still come up with some savings to cover the cost of it over time, and I still think you'll get, well, we don't know the cost of the Fairbanks, but without Fairbanks, the total savings over 5 years would be $3.5 million. So even if the Fairbanks thing costs you a significant amount of money, you'd still come out to the positive, I believe. I think this amendment would go toward making the whole bill more revenue neutral over the period of time and would have less detrimental effect on the poor children who are the main beneficiaries of the AFDC.
Okay, does the committee wish further discussion? Ready for the question? Clerk, please call the roll. No.
No.
Yes.
Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Amendment number 10 would add this language on page 4. And this is the section that deals with who does not have to participate in uncompensated activity under workfare. And right now, under the language already in the bill, and because of the jobs exclusion, people with children under 3 are exempted. And if we go ahead and expand that to age 6, it should reduce the cost of providing the child care benefits because people over 6 would be in school. And I think there's a lot to be said from a good for society point of view that these people with small children who are under school age be able to care for them as opposed to further pushing them into this uncompensated work situation. So I think this would be a good amendment and would probably reduce the cost of the program that is being contemplated here for workfare.
Any response?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Henley.
I have mixed emotions about this. Number one, we picked the jobs classification. I think people in the jobs program are required if they've got a 4-year-old or 5-year-old. I guess the argument is let the parents stay home with the kid. I would just suggest that the people that don't have this opportunity are required to go out and do that and provide child care for their kid. I mean, there's lots of people that work in the legislature that have children that would love to have the state do that. I don't have a real problem with this, although I think I've had some people suggest to me that we shouldn't allow it for people even under 3 years old. And I guess if we're going to get into some of the articles that you read are that one of the problems with some of these social programs is people get into a habit that is not normal in society, I guess, and that they don't have to. There's an incentive there to stay home, and I don't know whether it's better for us to leave parents at home or make them go out and do community service and work. And why is the jobs program? Maybe we could find out. Why do they have a 3-year-old limit? Why don't they have 6 years old? And what's the rationale behind that? We just picked the jobs program because we thought that made sense. There has to be some rationale behind the federal requirement.
Mr. Chair, Representative Hanley, I think that, to the best of my knowledge, the rationale behind the federal was a result of a political consensus. There were people, just as in your current comments, who thought that it should only be people who have older children, and there were people who thought that anyone after the child was a year old or even younger, and I think it was a matter of a bipartisan, the entire political spectrum finally coming to a consensus. And in the federal law, it is 3 years. It is mandatory with a 1-year option. And that also was part of the political consensus in Washington, D.C.
Representative Parnell.
What percentage of AFDC families have children under 6 versus have children under 3? In other words, would this just decimate the workfare program in a sense that you wouldn't have the pool of people available?
Mr. Chairman, I was sitting there wondering if someone was going to ask that. I don't have an answer. Kurt, do you? In fact, I was sitting there thinking, do we even know? Because we have to know the 3 and 1 year olds because of the current. There is a large number, perhaps even a majority, of AFDC families that have children under age 6. Because, I'm trying to think, 33% of the children on AFDC are under the age of 3. I believe that. I was recently analyzing those statistics. I don't know what percentage of the families, though. But.
Representative Navarre.
Chairman, I knew this amendment was coming up, and that's why I voted against Amendment 5, which was to eliminate the workfare program. I think that with the addition of this amendment, it's in the project area, you'll still have some good evidence of whether or not it works. And at the same time, you preserve the family unit for the people who are on under 6 years of age. You might be able to make it under 5 years since we now fund the kindergarten program in the foundation program. But I think that we certainly, I think this amendment makes sense. Believe me, I had my nephew who was 14 years old down last week, and that was a full-time job.
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Henley?
And maybe I can ask Jan this. One of the concerns I would have, I want to make sure where it's a two-parent family that both don't, get a, you know, that both don't say their person. I mean, I would think that at least one of them, if we're going to do this, would be, I'm not sure, because there are some two-parent up, they're called up families. So you wouldn't necessarily want to exempt both of the families because they both say they personally provide care. I guess one or the other at one time or another could shift it, but.
Is one of?
Mr. Chairman, and perhaps Kurt Lomas can better instruct us here. I would think that there was leeway here that this exempts, that would allow us to draft regulations in which only one parent in a two-parent family is considered to be providing care for the child.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, I'm Kurt Lomas, Division of Public Assistance. In jobs exemption rules, in two-parent families, only one parent can be exempted as a caretaker of a young child. It's for a child under 3 in the jobs rules. And I think given the statutory language, we would construct regulations that mirror the jobs exemption rules.
Representative Hennett?
That's fine if they can do that. I don't particularly have a...
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I have some data before me that responds to Representative Parnell's. It's not an exact, but I do have in front of me that of the children on AFDC, there's of the 25,000 children on AFDC in January of 94, about 8,000 of those children are 3 or under. If we want to go under 3, there's about 6,000 that are under 3, and under 6, is about, there's about 2,000 in each category, so it looks like there's about 12,000, about half of those are under the age of 6. I don't know how this breaks out in families, but that perhaps helps to instruct.
Yeah, there's, Mr. Chairman, there's 12,688 children 6 or under on the program, 10,600 over the age of 6, but what we don't know is the distribution of that among the families. And
okay, we got a motion to adopt amendment number 10. Are the objections maintained?
Yes.
Any objections? Did Representative Navarre have a question?
Looking for some acceptable here. I think it makes sense. I don't know how many of those 10,000, 12,000, whatever the number is.
Chipping away.
How many live in the project area?
How many of them are from, the average is only one, maybe, most of them are how many of them are in the same family, so that, you know, that's the distribution we don't know, but I still think that it makes sense. Believe me, you're putting a pretty onerous burden on single parents of small children, with the amount of welfare that they get to go out and do this work. I mean, a real onerous burden. That's my argument.
Okay, the one question I have is, we're establishing a controlled group. If this amendment was adopted, would it affect the viability of that? Maybe that's not the right word, of the control group. Would it still be
statistically correct?
Mr. Chairman, I think.
And would the soundness of the control group still be there?
Sounds like you're doubling the numbers of kids, basically. But you don't know that that would double the numbers of families, because some of them are going to be in a family where there's a 3-year-old or a 2-year-old and a 5-year-old. They would already be exempted because they've got a younger kid. One thing we did put in here is 65% in the test group figure rather than 50-50, so because of some of these kinds of things. So it may, I guess Jan could answer, but I would think there'd still be enough.
Mr. Chairman, in terms of whether there's enough, it would reduce the number, but there are still a lot. One of the things that I hear and would concern me is that we not get too detailed, because we will have to, even under this bill, negotiate a demonstration project with the federal government. If there's a desire that it be 6 rather than 3 if possible, then we would negotiate that. But I think that if there was a constraint on 6, I don't know whether that would affect the viability of the control group as you've raised it. And I don't know how language would be constructed, nor do I have a sense of what the members want to have here. But in some things, when we're getting down, if there's an issue that we want it to be 6, but we don't want to ruin the viability of the project, if somehow there's just language given and that we attempt to negotiate in good faith with the federal government to do it with a fallback position, is the thoughts that I was having as I listened to this discussion.
Representative Brown.
But if we didn't adopt this amendment, you wouldn't have the flexibility to just arbitrarily exclude people who the law says now they must work at this uncompensated activity, would you? Would you have the authority to do that? What you're suggesting, well, gee, we'd like to have it this way and we'll negotiate to have it that way. I don't think you would.
Mr. Chairman, the way it is here, we would include all people with children over age 3. However, I would remind that as the fiscal notes are constructed, we do not anticipate that everyone in the control group would actually, that there would be enough community service slots generated for every person in the control group. So we cost it out in the fiscal note a finite number of community service slots based on what we think is going to be possible with a certain level of staffing and with the economic and employment, employer participation in the state. So it could be that we could fill every slot with people whose children are over 6. I can't say that right now.
Okay, we had objections to amendment number 10. Are the objections maintained?
Yes.
Okay, would the clerk please call the roll?
Ontario.
No.
Representative Brown.
Yes.
Representative Foster.
Yes.
Representative Hanley.
Yes.
Representative Hoffman.
Yes.
Representative Martin.
No.
Representative Navarre.
Yes.
Representative Carnell.
No.
Representative Larson.
Yes.
Representative McCain.
Yes.
7-8, green A.
Just to note that amendment number 10 has been adopted. Amendment number 11. Representative Brown.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This amendment would limit the amount of time that someone would have to participate in workfare in the uncompensated activity to 13 weeks, make the 13 weeks the mandatory part. This would give more opportunity to rotate people through there. And I think that considering the types of job opportunities that are likely to be available, makes some sense that a person could go there and work for a short period of time, gain that experience, gain whatever skills there are to be gained from that, and not set up a permanent system of requiring people to work for uncompensated activity.
And you moved amendment?
I'll move number 11.
Okay, hearing objections, discussion?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Henley.
And this is one of my concerns. This is one of the suggestions or one of the things in the reports that I've read that have suggested that one of the reasons they don't work is that it's not a requirement continually, that it's a 13-week thing and then it's over. And if you look at the way the bill's structured, there's actually an incentive to get paid work, even if it's only not full-time work, but there's a 10-hour-per-week requirement for paid work or 21 hours of community service. And I think at that point, people, if there's a need to change habits or whatever, that I think this needs to be a continuing process. And in fact, like I mentioned in the Ohio project, there was no end limit to it, and there was a substantial amount of time per week that were required, and those seemed to be the factors that demonstrated some savings in the project. So I would be, and in fact, the 13 weeks were mentioned in a number of articles as to why they felt there were no savings or change in habits. So I would oppose this particular amendment.
Further discussion on amendment number 11?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Martin.
Well, there's nothing to prohibit people right now, whether they're on welfare or not, to work for a nonprofit organization or wherever they want. And that's a great way for them to have opportunity to learn and to get experience in being on a job on time and training to get some skills and so on. And so here you have something you're going to put into legislation which isn't prohibitive now. Perhaps we should encourage them. But I'm also worried about this here. Once you put it in legislation, then you may have choicer organizations to misuse the people, to say, look, if you work for me for 13 weeks or whatever, to work at the barbershop or beauty salon. And I'm wondering here if they may be used. Somehow, however, people might feel, and the agencies might feel, well, we don't have any paid job for you right now, but we want you to work over here, we want you to work there, and so on. And someone may get a lot of free service for nothing without a true voluntary effort.
Commissioner.
Representative Brown.
I'd like to ask Ms. Hansen if she, in her work on the topic, has come across information that would be helpful to this discussion. But I just said to Representative Martin, it seems like that potential of using people, as you've said, is there, whether it's 13 weeks or indefinite or whatever, that to the extent that's a problem, it's a problem underlying the concept, not a problem with this amendment. But what I'd like to ask is, Ms. Hansen is familiar with the studies on the topic, and do you think that limiting it in this way would be beneficial or detrimental to long-term sustainable employment for people?
Mr. Chairman, some of the studies I've read, of course, are the same ones that Representative Hanley just referenced, which is that one school of thought is that if it is just a short-term requirement, it doesn't have as much value. Another school of thought is that if it's a long-term requirement, no one has really done that, and they're not sure how it can be sustained. So that's kind of a non-answer there. But I have two other points I'd like to make. One, with a provision 13 weeks out of every 12 months, we've estimated 1,000 people in community work slots, but this would mean only 25% of their time was available. With the previous amendment of eliminating from the pool those whose children are in between ages 3 to 6, we've just reduced the pool to some degree, and we don't know how much. This would reduce it even more so that it's possible that we wouldn't have enough available clients to fill what we anticipate up to the 1,000 slots. So I put that out in terms of the number of people. The other piece I guess I'd bring up to the debate here is I've not heard really, nor have we thrown out, what we're talking about when we say uncompensated activity. And one of the studies that I read recently from one state that has in fact, they have a contract with their clients up front as to what the uncompensated activity would be, and they include things like job search, self-initiated training that is allowed under the uncompensated activity. As I hear the debate here, we have talked a lot about putting people into unpaid employment as the uncompensated activity. It's possible to do this and have that required uncompensated activity cover a broader array of items, many of which are, some people see are more likely to help a person get a job, or the combination of doing unpaid work in a nonprofit for 6 months and doing 3 months of job search, or after that actually coming in and confirming to us that you were at the university in a vocational training on WordPerfect for 30 hours a week. It's possible that those could be included. In that case, you'd want them to be in it for the full year because there was a broad enough array of activities.
Further discussion on amendment number 11.
I'll withdraw it if the committee would like.
Are there objections to amendment number 11 being withdrawn? Hearing none, amendment number 11 is withdrawn. Do we have any more amendments?
Mr. Chairman, we have amendment number 2, which we bypassed initially.
Amendment number 2, that is correct.
And if I could speak on that.
I can find it. Go ahead and speak.
Okay. Well, Mr. Chairman, I offered this amendment because I feel that it's a very positive idea that would do something to affect the long-term ability of people to be self-sustaining and self-supporting. I will not offer this amendment at this time as being attached to this bill because I would like to find a revenue-neutral amendment within the budget that would actually fund it. And as Representative Hanley stated, he doesn't wish to allocate any of the savings from the ratable to funding this particular idea, so I think it makes more sense to offer it in the context of a budget amendment, and I will be revising this to form some budget intent, and I believe that would structurally work. I do think that we should be taking a holistic view of the problem and that there are other approaches as well that are probably at least as promising, if not more promising, than the first steps we're doing in this bill. Representative Davis has been doing research on the possibility of establishing micro activities where we would get waiver from the federal government to allow people to accumulate more business assets and make small loans available to them so they could buy a sewing machine or a computer or a snowblower or some kind of small equipment to be able to become self-sustaining in that way. I think that's a very positive approach that's just not allowed now. People can't become self-sustaining if they're not allowed to accumulate assets and have no access to capital, because that's how people with money make money. But we're not allowing that. So I think, although I'm very much in support of this, I think there are probably better places for it to be than on this bill.
Okay. Do we have any amendments then to any additional amendments?
Mr. Chairman?
Representative Parnell.
A rhetorical comment. Last time I went out in the hallway, I saw the Xerox machines staffed, both Xerox machines staffed by Representative Brown's staff, and I was concerned that we were going to see a lot more amendments come. but they had nothing to do with this committee meeting.
Well, they had the machine downstairs.
What action does the committee wish on committee substitute for House Bill 409, Finance Amended?
Verdict.
Representative Brown.
Thank you. Do we have new fiscal notes that reflect the changes in this bill?
I have not seen them.
And I would move that we hold the bill until we have the proper fiscal notes.
Okay.
Okay, we have objections to holding the bill. Any discussion? Representative Terrio?
Well, I know Ms. Hansen talked about working on factoring in the cost of Amendment Number 1, and I'm just wondering if she can tell us where we are along that timeline.
Mr. Chairman, in terms of developing fiscal notes, we did start on the one amendment that was passed. We have done nothing on the other amendments. The timeline on getting fiscal notes?
Okay, the question is the fiscal note in regards to the addition of Fairbanks into the waiver area.
We're not friends when I need them.
Close of business Monday.
If this motion passes, of course, we would hold the bill. If this motion fails, we would move the bill from committee, but we wouldn't move it with the fiscal notes at this time. We wouldn't move it until we got the fiscal note.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I'm not trying to hold the bill beyond when the time the fiscal notes are ready, and I think that's required anyway. So I would also suggest that the fiscal note on the child care should be looked at to see whether the amendment that was made affects the projected cost of the child care.
Representative Terrio?
Mr. Chairman, I'm concerned, maybe you can tell me, if we don't take action to actually move the bill, even though it's got to be held for fiscal votes, and we just hold it where it is, what does that do as far as the possibility of the bill still being, in my mind, kind of in second reading, where we can see more amendments proposed? What action do we take to move it beyond that position?
Well, no one has moved that. We moved the bill from committee yet. The only motion we have
tonight.
Is
I'm about to, but
one that we do not move the bill on, from committee until we get the fiscal notes. So that's the motion that's before us now.
I guess I don't have a problem with getting the fiscal notes and taking a look at them. I kind of separate that from taking action on changing the wording of the bill, though.
I think we're getting paranoid.
Mr. Chairman, I don't intend to offer any more amendments in committee on this bill, so however you wish to handle it, I do not plan to offer more amendments.
Can we have a guarantee? It's your staff I'm worried about,
right,
not you.
Amendments on the floor.
If you withdraw your motion, Representative Brown, I would then entertain a motion that we move the bill from committee with individual recommendations in the accompanying fiscal notes. And at that point, then I would move that we hold the bill until we get those fiscal notes.
Okay, I just say, how can we be moving the bill from committee with the accompanying fiscal notes that we don't have?
We aren't. We're just making the motion to do that. We're not voting on it.
I'll withdraw my motion.
At this time, I'd entertain a motion then that we move the bill from committee with the accompanied revised fiscal notes to reflect the child care, the age 6, and the addition of Fairbanks. Do we have a motion?
I move.
Here we have a motion by Representative Mark. At this point, then, and pending at this point, we are going to hold this bill until we get those fiscal notes. Then when we have those fiscal notes, the committee will review the fiscal notes, and then we will vote on the motion. Okay? Hopefully we can do that by 1:30 tomorrow afternoon. No?
Mr. Chairman, we cannot have fiscal notes on all of this.
Monday.
Monday.
No, don't delay too long.
Tomorrow's Wednesday.
Mr. Chairman, the Fairbanks fiscal note, it appears, today is Tuesday, that we can have that one by the end of day Thursday.
About Friday morning.
I can't have all of them by Friday morning.
And have all.
How about Saturday?
I have
Monday at 8:30.
Monday at 8:30.
See, this is a House bill, and to delay it a week now for a fiscal note at this stage of the session is a
disaster.
Major delay. I hate to kill a major bill because we can't get a fiscal note prepared.
Would the fiscal note be more or less for the child care? I mean, for the six? Age six. So I think it's going to be less.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the child care will be...
We're exempting more people.
It's going to be more for the Fairbanks addition. It's going to be less because of the age six.
Actually, it might not be. We're just exempting certain people. If there's still enough people to fill those slots, it could be the exact same. That's the debate, I guess.
I guess, Mr. Chairman, it's appropriate to ask, do we have a bill that we have now that we're doing fiscal notes on, or?
You have a bill that you have fiscal notes on because we've been told that there's going to be no more amendments in the Finance Committee. And the only thing that's pending before the Finance Committee will be to review those fiscal notes and then to vote on moving the bill from committee with the company just
the only idea made the reason put amendment to
answer
your
question. We will take the bill and we will roll out the adopted amendments into a finance.
You can do it in moves.
I will see that you get a copy of that at finance. You will have a bill before you draft your next
one. Well, you can do it in moves.
Mr. Chairman, 8:30 Monday.
Pardon?
8:30 Monday.
That's still a whole week.
No, it's 6 days.
Friday
make
afternoon.
Make a depending fiscal note
Tuesday,
and change it in rules.
It's Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday.
Friday at 1:30.
In defense of staff here, I know I had a conversation with the division director. I believe you're looking at our AFDC program staff. The original set of fiscal notes was about 150 staff hours in preparation. This is not an attempt to. Really a problem in terms of
Yeah, and I'm just, you know, we're bumping against the deadline when we got to have bills at a finance committee. And when you're talking about next Monday is a holiday, and we don't have meetings possibly on Monday. We're going the next Tuesday, and that's the very last day that we have to get bills out of this committee that don't have to do with the budget. And that's cutting it too thin.
Yeah. Why can't we have a revised fiscal note as we had in other committees too? They got the best shot right now. In Rules Committee, it's been allowed in the past, and on the floor, it's been allowed.
We know what it's going to cost in Mattsu, and if we know it's going to cost in Anchorage, can't we have a pretty good estimate to what it's going to be in Fairbanks?
Mr. Chairman, we have a pretty good estimate right now. I've just been conferring with Kurt while this discussion was going on, and because of where we are on costing out Fairbanks and the additional piece, he tells me he thinks that we can make 130 on Friday.
Okay. Good. That'll get at least give me 2 days before the deadline.
And I truly will do it. If I can do it faster than that, I will. But I don't want to commit to something that we can't.
We'll be waiting for your miracle. Thank you.
Those things happen around Easter all the time.
Okay, the next bill we have before us today will be House Bill 347. Okay, it's an act relating to long-term plans of certain state agencies, and it's sponsored by Representative Parnell. It does have four fiscal notes, one from DOT, Administration, Community and Regional Affairs, and the Department of Health and Social Services.
I move we zero out the fiscal notes, pass out the bill.
And if you accept the work draft of the committee substitute, there will be no fiscal notes. So.
I'm just joking.
Yeah. Representative Parnell, tell us about the committee substitute.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. HB 347, you should have a committee substitute work draft on your desk that was just prepared. Work draft U. Let me just describe a little bit about what problem this is meant to address, as I think we will find ourselves in greater agreement on this bill than the previous bill. Some of the underlying problems that this is meant to address, one is that I don't think there's any rational or objective way to address priorities for budget choices we're making. When we look at the budget in subcommittee or here, a lot of our decisions are made strictly on dollar amounts and little on and few decisions are made on any rational priority basis. Secondly, I think there's a basic distrust of government and the belief that it doesn't work for the average person. My personal experience with the budget shows that when departments come to us in subcommittees, they come to us from a few different ways. But for instance, the Department of Public Safety, they came to me and said, we have 300 fewer troopers now than we did 5 years ago, or DOT will tell you how many lane miles of highway they have to maintain. Or the Department of Education will talk to you about pupil-teacher ratios. And instead, I think the measures need to be focused on the customer and the consumer. For instance, with Department of Public Safety, I think they should be measuring their performance on how many people were killed on the Seward Highway, for instance, or how safe are the areas that they're patrolling, rather than focusing on strict dollar amounts. For DOT, one measurement of their success that we could gauge their success on would be what level of road maintenance is acceptable to the public at any particular point. And throughout the subcommittee process, I found a complete lack of long-range planning or any kind of accountability for what they were doing. And so HB 347 is an attempt to put a framework in place that would enable us to make those decisions in a better fashion. For instance, just in short, what this bill does is it enables the agencies to set their goals and objectives. They set their measurements that they set their checkpoints along the way to those goals and objectives. So we have a way of measuring how they're doing and progressing towards those goals and objectives. And then finally, they get reported back to the public in the form of the budget bill or the appropriations bill, but in the form of a long-range plan that's submitted yearly. The process is known by many names. Most currently and most recently, it's called performance-based budgeting. It's not a new concept. It's been around for some time. Tried with varying degrees of success. In fact, in the last subcommittee, or in the last committee in state affairs, Representative Ulmer commented that, gee, this sounds an awful lot like something we did under Jay Hammond.
Oh, you were there.
She was there. She was implementing it, and she said it was a really good program we implemented, a really good system we implemented. And then she was asked what happened to it, and she said, "Well, we got a lot of money in, and we spent well beyond any rational well beyond any rational way of spending, and well beyond any priorities that had been established." So she expressed an interest at that committee at seeing this, in her words, I think, resurrected as a way of dealing with declining revenues and prioritizing your budget choices. Let me just tell you briefly what HB 347 does. In fact, I think you've got a timeline in your packet. At number one on the timeline, on May 1 of each year, the governor submits his or her goals and objectives for the year in broad terms. By July 1, the departments by then have submitted their goals and objectives to OMB for review and approval. By October 1, and this is all tracking our current budget process, by October 1, each agency issues its long-term plan to OMB, and the plan is to cover a 6-year period. It's then submitted on December 15 to, along with the budget for all the departments. So it's an ongoing process. If you look at the way Texas has implemented this program, and I hate to use that word program because it's not, it's just a new way of looking at budgeting. When you open up their budget bill, and I failed to get copies made before this hearing, but if you open up their budget, you don't look at line items like personal services and contractual. You look at line items like goals, objectives, and strategies, and their performance measures are in there. It says how many people they're budgeting for, that they're planning for in public safety in terms of safety of their roads, how many people are going to be injured or killed on a particular highway. And that way we know exactly what we're budgeting for year after year. I think it provides a rational way to align our state resources in years of declining revenues. I am, and my staff is working very closely with the Office of Management and Budget. They're here today to discuss their involvement. And to their credit, they have been involved in trying to implement performance-based budgeting at the state level for about a year now. Jack Farniali can talk about some of those efforts here. Just a couple of comments in closing. I just want to point out that this is meant to be a tool for us to use here. It's meant for us, it should make our job easier in the sense that instead of having to sit through endless subcommittee meetings trying to figure out what the departments are trying to accomplish, we will have in writing exactly what they're trying to accomplish, and we will have a basis for making our budget decisions in a more rational manner. So at that, Mr. Chairman, I would just urge your support of HB 347 and also just ask that we hear from OMB as well.
Thank you. Let's hear from Jack then from OMB. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, my name is Jack Farniuli. I'm with the Director's Office at OMB. We support this legislation. As Representative Parnell has mentioned, we've had a process underway, a planning process, for the better part of a year now, and have been desirous for some time, even before then, of moving to this kind of a budgeting system. For two reasons. One, I think in the short run, is that we feel that having some kind of productivity and results-oriented measures in the budget would give us some sense of whether what we're doing is accomplishing what we want it to be doing. Now, a lot of it is the recipe for bear stew, get one bear and boil it, but given a set of gubernatorial or legislative policy objectives for the state or a set of benchmarks similar to other states have used to develop through a public hearings process, however the goals are arrived at, if some consensus on those goals can be reached, then we feel some kind of a measurement system would be crucial to determining whether we're making progress toward those results. And that would be, frankly, a very different kind of budget than we now produce. As you know in great detail from looking at budget submissions, most often what we actually see and are able to put together are measures of input or effort thrown at problems, but no real clues as to whether we're making desirable progress toward solving the problems we wish to solve, or even whether those are the right problems, quote, to be trying to solve. Performance-based budgeting in this sense will be no silver bullet, but we do feel that it will provide us with at least a mechanism for asking the right questions and measuring results toward agreed-upon goals. The second reason we feel that it's an important approach to take in budgeting is that in the long run, maybe a year or two, given our fiscal situation, we somehow need to be able to get to the point where we can have some empirical basis, if you will, to the question of what lines of business should the state be in versus the lines of business it should not be in. We don't really have a budgetary basis at present for grappling with those questions, and we do feel that both the process of goal setting and measurement of results would be something of strategic value to the state as we go into this era of increasing questioning about what the state government ought to be doing in terms of what it provides to its citizens. We have had a work group process going for a year. We fully intend to propose and develop this process with or without the legislation, frankly. And so when Representative Parnell made it known that he was interested in this legislation, it matched up very closely with our own goals for this budgeting process. And for that reason, we do endorse it. We, like I say, expect to be doing this ourselves over the coming summer. This will be my instructions are to devote all of my time to it as soon as we're free from session. And OMB plans on having a major role in redeveloping the budget process, well, as I say, whether this is enacted into law or not. What we would expect and what the bill calls for is a close coordination between the Legislative Budget and Audit Committee on the legislature side with OMB, both in terms of the inputs to the goals that are identified at the beginning and as a certainly reviewer and evaluator of the budget documents and the performance estimates that are used in that budget document. So our approach, as well as the legislation's approach, is predicated on that kind of a close relationship, and we feel that the legislation is strengthened by explicitly calling for that. We've had a lot of talk with Representative Parnell's staff about what our timetables might be, what would be the best timetables, what would be the impacts of moving to this process. I'll be able to respond maybe to some questions you may have, but in general, we see it as not establishing a separate track, i.e. the development of a plan or a series of plans that would be separate from and independent from the budget development process. We would see them as supplanting, or we would see this effort as being integrated with and supplanting a good part of our budget development process. Now, this presumes a fair amount of discussion and education, frankly, both within the executive branch as possibly as well as in the finance committee and subcommittee structures, because if we were to get to the point of developing a new budget format and a new process for interpreting goals and measuring progress toward them, that would be as important to have a complete understanding at the operational level on the legislative subcommittee side as well as in OMB and in the department stages. So we see a fair amount necessarily of co-involvement in developing the entire process, were this legislature to go forward or not. But just to make that point clear, we do see it as becoming part of, a good part of, the budget process, not something ancillary or independent from it. That's...
Brown, you had a question?
Yeah, I had a couple. With respect to the fiscal notes and the cost of it, I was just looking for the DOT one to see why there's so much, but is the only change in the committee substitute the new Section 2 phasing it in?
No, I believe, Mr. Chair, I believe there are several other changes. That Rich Vitale, if you could come up. That's the one point I wanted to mention that neither Jack nor I talked about, is that the new committee substitute contains a phase-in where OMB would choose three departments to implement this within in 95, actually for fiscal year 96, and then all the rest of the departments would come online the following year. Shelby Stassen indicated he believed it was important to work with basically the easiest departments first to convert to the system so that he could get things in line as best he could and work out the bugs with a smaller pool of departments. And Rich, if you could please, with a quick to describe the other, there were two more changes, I believe.
Yeah, I believe a line from regarding the issuance of documents to the state library and the reference library was moved from section one to on the first page to the second page in section B. I believe you'll find it in your committee substitute on line 10, starting line 9, four copies shall be sent. It's just a minor change of when it should be issued. Instead of being issued in the early part of the cycle, it's issued at the end.
The other major change was changing it from every 2 years to a yearly process, tracking our budget, our annual budget, rather than the budget period of the 2 years in Texas.
Any reference around the Navarre?
Yeah, at one time I had proposed legislation that would go to a biannual budgeting process because I felt like the agencies and the whole government was consuming way too much effort and activity in just producing all these papers, because most of which, you know, we don't even have time to look at. They're so voluminous and, you know, not that much changes. So I'm really wondering about the feasibility of preparing a whole new plan every year. And I'm thinking about the experience that we've had in the telecommunications area, where a number of years ago a requirement was adopted that every department have a long-range telecommunications plan. It's just taken forever for all the departments to get some kind of plan. Then there's supposed to be a single plan, but there really never has been one. And the single plan that we have is more or less a compilation of the individual plans. And I'm just thinking about whether it's really feasible or desirable to redo this thing every year. I mean, you know, what is going to change that much that would make you want to start completely over and redo the long-range plan every year?
I'd be happy to answer that, or Jack, if you want to.
Mr. Chairman, I agree with Representative Brown. There is a major difference, however, between the experience of the telecommunications plan and what's being proposed here. What she says about the telecommunications plan is absolutely true. I think the big difference here is that we're talking about making it part of the budget process, and it will get the attention and the resources that that process entails, as opposed to the telecommunications plan right now, which has been sort of added on to their responsibilities and has always been begging for resources and attention. So I wouldn't expect at all the same outcome for those reasons between this and the telecommunications plan. This would be budget-driven and would have to be done, and that makes all the difference in the world.
Representative Navarre?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I know that 2 years ago we gave OMB some money to do an organizational efficiency task force study, and we got the report back. And I know some of it's been implemented. But I'm just wondering, instead of delaying this until 95, October 95 for the first plan, whether or not a plan could be done this year in the fall for the three agencies if we gave OMB probably some meager amounts of funding in order to provide for it. And the reason I suggest that is because then, instead of the second year of a legislative session, we have it in the first year of a legislative session, and I guess whether you have it every year after that, I guess once you have the forms in place, if it becomes part of the budget process, it probably won't be that significant. But just so we can see then, in the next legislature, have an opportunity maybe to find out whether or not it is working.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative Cornell?
We discussed that, and that is a handicap for our legislature coming in next year, but it's only a handicap at that point, and if it's a handicap, it's a handicap now, too, because we don't have that information. One of the reasons why we put it off to 96 is because these timelines right now, by the time the bill gets signed, we'll already be into them. By May 1, the governor should have submitted his goals and objectives. By July, the agencies should have developed it, so we're already in the midst of that timeline. And frankly, it just seemed like a better idea to start it when, you know, it started the next year. And so that was the only reason why. There was no other thought besides that.
As Representative Parnell says, we did talk about that, and it would be, we feel, it would be a real crunch for us to try and make up for that loss of time this year, because, frankly, our original intent had been to try and time something for introduction in the next budget cycle, but we have not been able to do that, and we realistically wouldn't get to it, as far as OMB is concerned, until probably after vetoes, fully a month after end of session. Also, with the fact, I think, that the bill has been changed in the CS to be annual, because we worried a lot about trying to match it up, in discussing this, Representative Parnell, we all worried a lot about trying to match it up with the two-year cycle of the legislature. We felt that was really desirable, to get it in front of a new legislature each time. But now, by making the process an annual one, and our feeling on that was that we're going to be updating annually anyway, so with 2 years or 1 year, it really didn't make too much difference to us. But that with it being annual, you really would not be permanently on a system of being off 1 year, really. So that would be a problem.
Something else that you didn't mention and I hadn't considered is in your timeline this year, you weren't incorporating the likelihood of a special session.
We were not.
Any further discussion? Representative Brown.
Thank you. Looking at the fiscal notes, it seems to me that if we do this, there will be some fiscal impact, although maybe it's just displaced. And I guess Representative Parnell said if we adopt the committee substitute, there is no fiscal note. Is that really what you meant, or you meant just there's no cost in FY95 and these costs start up in subsequent years?
That's correct, because the Shelby Stastny informed me yesterday that he would not choose either of the three departments that put a fiscal note on it for the pilot program, simply because those departments will be more difficult to implement this. They'll need more time to get this implemented.
And then I would like to ask Representative Parnell if he has had time to scrutinize the fiscal notes for HES and DOT. Because DOT is proposing to add, you know, a significant amount of money, as is HES, which seems like, you know, I can see that there would be some fiscal impact. It almost seems to me like the most fiscal impact would be on the Office of the Governor, or that you almost need a dedicated person or small group that's going to make this happen. Otherwise, it's just too far flung. Because one of the things that really needs to happen that's not happening now is the integration between agencies with related functions. I think that's one of the big holes in our effort overall, is all the departments plan like this and tend to want to proceed as if they were the only ones. And, you know, it's very difficult to get them. And I see that as a really positive thing that could come out of an effort like this. But I guess it would seem to me you would want to have more resources. To the extent you were going to have more resources, it would make sense to have them in the Office of the Governor, and that we ought to consider the idea, you know, of do we need to specifically mention that agencies with related functions, you know, they should really have sub-plans. We should have a plan for the criminal justice system. We should have a plan for natural resources development that picks up all the related agencies, and I think that, you know, would be a good approach to it.
The Jack, did you want to respond to that? I saw you.
If you would like, Mr. Chairman, we agree, Representative Brown, that the related functions, the program areas that spread over departments, that'll have to be a key second slant that we take on it. Obviously, we won't be able to or want to take it out simply agency by agency. As far as the question of the resources, a couple of points on that. One is that you're right, we do expect OMB and the governor's office to bear the brunt of the training costs. We're still in discussion on these fiscal notes, let me say that. But we do expect, and this is what we've told the agencies in preparing their fiscal notes, that OMB would bear the brunt of the training costs. We gave them a set of assumptions to use in preparing their fiscal notes. I don't know if you have them in your packets, but if not, we can make them available to you. Essentially, we told them that OMB would bear the training costs. The work of developing the results measures or the performance measures with the departments, we gave them the assumption to use that half of that effort would come from OMB. We also gave them the assumption that any public hearings attendant to the development of goals, either departmental goals or statewide goals, would be borne not by the departments. Now, as the bill has changed a little bit, that may be different, but this is partly what they're suffering under in preparing their fiscal notes. So for the most part, what you see as the costs that are in the fiscal notes right now are the department's estimates of staff they will need. Now, this is itself an area still under discussion. But for example, DOT has come in for 5 staff, I believe, one for each of the 3 districts, one for the ferry system, one for statewide. Health and Social Service, CNRA, and admin also have basically coordinative staff they've proposed. We're still discussing with them because our feeling is that we intend to supplant resources that are currently used in the budget process. So I would take these at that value. We're still in discussions with them, and we have not ironed it out yet. With the new CS on the table, we started this morning a new round of talks with them, so they may not end up in the form you see before you now. The one that, department that's really the different one in the whole bunch of the 4 is Health and Social Services. What you'll find in their fiscal note is primarily, I think, a $100,000 or so figure for the development of a contract for data standards. Now, I haven't had a chance to go into this in great detail with the department, but I do know from working with them on other information systems issues that on its face, that's not incommensurate with their apparent need to develop data standards and develop their management information systems across divisions in the department. Whether or not, how much of that may be due to the requirements of this bill versus how much may be due to requirements they have right now, I frankly can't tell you yet, but that is the only one of a different kind in that batch. The rest, I think, are all staff-related issues. As I say, we're still talking with them on that. As Representative Parnell said, the understanding so far between Shelby Stastny and Representative Parnell is that the 3 departments to be picked would not be those among these 4, largely because, at least in a couple of the cases, these 4 represent departments, as Representative Parnell said, that are large and have problems of scale. So we haven't yet developed a methodology for how we'll select the individual departments, but what we would be looking for is, my understanding, some set of departments that would give us representative features of the system, you know, that would be valuable as a pilot. So we will look for some that have grant programs. We would look for some that have internal support functions rather than public support functions. That methodology is still being developed. But we would definitely not go to our most complicated state department like Health and Social Services to try and build a pilot on that basis, because we feel there may be some intractability there as well as complexity.
Okay, we're going to go about two more minutes. Representative Brown?
Well, I don't know. Is your intention to move this bill right now?
I would like to. I mean, I think it makes sense to do it and get it out.
I'd suggest we should not, or just have a zero fiscal note for all these departments and have a small fiscal note for the governor, a new revised fiscal note that just goes with the CS, and then if the governor decides that those resources are more needed in the department, they can parcel them out in some manner. I would not want to see the bill go with no resources on it, because I think, you know, it does have some impact there, and that would be a good way to short circuit Jack having to go back and re-explain this to everybody and have all these agencies redo all these fiscal notes, and that would be an appropriate way to set it up, and then the governor could later pass them out if they conclude there's a problem that keeps an agency from doing it.
Okay, Representative Navarre?
That's fine. Not going to be.
Do you have a amount you'd like to suggest, Representative Brown?
Why don't we, Mr. Chairman, if we could ask Jack Farnielli, since OMB would be the recipient of that money, what would they need for training?
Could you give us a quick figure and we could then draft a...
Well, we've discussed a figure. I would offer it preliminarily and then confirm it through Shelby Stastny to the committee. He's talked in the range of $50,000 to $100,000.
Okay, so if I understand then what Representative Brown's request is that instead of having a zero fiscal note for 95, that we have a fiscal note in a range of 50?
75,000. Well, 50,000 is fine, Mr. Chair.
Whatever Shelby Stanley says, because he's pretty damn conservative.
Yeah.
I know, that's why I took the lower end. I think he could do it there.
So the motion is to zero out everybody's fiscal notes here, with the exception of...